Dr. Rock's radio show. Every Thursday night at 9 on raconteursnews.com. We go to 11.
Eddie and the Hot Rods there, and ignore them, and indeed that's what we should be doing. This is Dr. Rock's radio show, coming to you live from a field in Norfolk on raconteursnews.com. We're on 12 volts tonight and open source, so we're completely... we had to move ourselves a bit away from the main festival. The other places we were looking at broadcasting had so much noise. All of the stages are really close together, so that would have been fun, but perhaps a bit of a challenge for you all. So here we are. We kicked off the show with a band that we saw last night who are really cracking. They're called Solana, and that was a track from the Travelling Fair, their album, and it's called Sleepwalker. And they were followed by Mobius Loop, who I've become really addicted to over the last bit. As some of you will know, we met them at the Conscious Tribal Gathering last weekend, and as it so happens, they're here at the Harlequin Fair as well. So we'll be having another tune from both of them later, and we will also be chatting with Mobius Loop and various associated people, both about the band and about their hemp redemption project, because they make the most wicked hemp hot chocolate. Kept me out of bed till half two in the morning, you know, you lot did. So, in the meantime, we've got Pippa King's joined us again. She's here talking about the surveillance state, and was even more terrifying than she was last year. Thanks for being here, Pippa.
Oh, don't say that, Nick. But thank you very much for having me on. Yeah, it was. It's the Pentos talk space at this fair is absolutely amazing, with some great speakers on, and with yourself as well speaking. So it's great to be here. So thank you.
Well, thanks very much for being here and bringing us up to date. So perhaps we might get a chance in future to talk in a bit more detail, but it'd be good to look at a few details that I think were new in your talk this year. I had never heard of cognitive biometrics. What the hell are cognitive biometrics?
So biometrics, the word biometric literally means life measure, so it's the way in which a computer program or a technical program can measure you and check that you are you. So you have things like fingerprint biometrics, which I think we're all familiar with that the police use, facial recognition. You can have voice biometrics, where the system sort of measures the inflections in your voice and the pauses in how you talk. So cognitive biometrics are very much a little bit like voice biometrics in the fact that they will measure the speed that you type on a computer, the sort of pressure that you put on certain keys on a computer, and how you interact with the mouse and the screen. So this sort of technology is used, for example, by the American military, where they will fingerprint somebody getting into a military industrial complex, and then they will confirm that it is the person that's using the computer, that it should be that person, and it's not somebody else that's logged in under a different password or whatever. And so the computer is analysing the human that's using it to make sure it is the human that's meant to be using it.
I used to run a stores, and it would have been bloody useful to have a system that was doing that, because they always used to cock it up and blame it on somebody else.
Well, I guess this sort of technology is this is my interest in it, because my children were nearly fingerprinted when they were 6 and 7 in primary school just over a decade ago now, and every gene in my body was screaming that this is wrong and young children shouldn't be using this. I mean, I do, you know, we've got these really sophisticated surveillance technologies that do have their place, I think, in society, sort of not in society as general public, but for security reasons, maybe in banking, where you've got vaults of gold or whatever, but certainly not in primary schools for...
The trouble is, with the banks, the criminals have already got the money, ma'am.
Yeah. And there's no gold left, obviously. So Chinese have all got it, but anyway, that's another thing. But, so they've been using fingerprint technology in school since 2001, and my kids nearly got fingerprinted in 2004. So I asked the head teacher of the school, because I spotted the scanner in the library, and I sort of said, when are you going to ask my permission? And she just looked me in the eyes and said, I don't need your permission to take your kids' fingerprints. And I was just like, really?
Of course they do. They do, don't they?
Well, they do now. Yeah. They do now, because I was so... it was just wrong for schools to be able to do that. But I mean, if anybody's listening out there that have got children in primary schools, you know that you have to sign consent for even walking across a playground to go to the swimming pool, or food testing, school trips, photographs, videos. So it just seemed absolutely bizarre that they were able to take my children's biometric fingerprint and not tell me about it, or even ask for consent. I mean, they didn't even tell me about it. It was only because I was on the PTA at the time and I spotted the fingerprint scanner in the library. And this is where coincidences sort of step in, because I had no knowledge of this whatsoever prior to seeing the fingerprint scanner, other than that literally 2 weeks earlier I had read an article on the internet talking about this technology in schools. And I just read the article and thought, that's absolutely bizarre, that's never going to catch on. And then the next thing I know, within sort of 2 weeks, I'm seeing the same scanner in my child's school.
I think things like that are really optimistic signs, because it's almost like the cosmos is trying to go, hey man, you really need to pay attention to this.
It is almost like that. It was very coincidental, and the article that I found, I can't even remember how I got to it, but so to cut a long story short, I ended up, after the head teacher had said that to me, I ended up going back to the article that I'd read. I got back in touch with the author that had written it, and she actually owned a little organisation called Action on Rights for Children. And I spoke to her, and she said, you know, we've had a couple of other parents ring in around the UK, do you fancy sort of talking to them, and we'll try and see if we can raise this issue in Parliament. And that's what we did.
We'll get on to the Parliament bit at the moment. What about the other parents? Because we're aware in Powys that there's people trying to close schools. There's a lot of people alarmed by it, but there seems to be a lot of parents who are just completely supine. How are you managing to make any impact with normal orthodox parents? I mean, are they even worried about the fact that their children are having their fingerprints taken?
That's a really good question, because parents, certainly in a primary school setting, parents drop off and pick up. Yeah. In a high school setting, parents don't. So there was a lot of chat in the playground about the biometric technology, and I would say probably about 30 to 40% of the parents really were not happy about it. Other parents really just didn't care. And because when you did a Google search or a search on the internet at that point in time, there was nothing at all on the internet about it. I mean, like zero on the internet about it. So what happened in my particular case was eventually the school asked us parents who wanted to opt out, and about 30 to 40% of the parents opted out of their kids using it, so in which case it was a dead duck in the water. They didn't actually go ahead with the biometric system. But sort of going back to nationally how parents were feeling, some parents were told by the head teachers that were introducing this technology into schools that if their kids weren't going to be fingerprinted for a canteen library system, that they had to literally go and eat their lunch outside in a shelter in the rain, and there was no flexibility at all. So the technology, I mean, we got some good articles in, we got an article in the Times Educational Supplement, in The Guardian, and I think particularly it was a contentious issue when fingerprinting children under 10. The industry quickly realised that actually that wasn't a good PR thing for them to do, so they took the technology out of primary schools, put it into secondary schools, so us parents couldn't communicate with each other.
Midrin's put.
I heard a story from a partner who's a school teacher that she didn't want her kids to be fingerprinted for getting lunch, and they had to bring their own packed lunch. That they couldn't let the kids have lunch without being fingerprinted. So I feel the schools are very bewildered as to what the hell they want this stuff for, and do they need it? Does anybody need it?
That was the bit of your talk today that really shocked me, was the measures that were being exacted upon children who didn't want to have their palm prints taken or their fingerprints, because it's not just a matter of being made to eat your meal in the bike sheds, is it? They were leaning on them quite a lot. They were coercion, basically.
Absolutely, and it's surprisingly still happening now. So what happened sort of from 2004, when I spotted the scanner in the library at my son's school, to 2010, there was myself and a fantastic group of about 4 to 9 parents that would meet up every sort of 4 to 6 months in London. We worked with No2ID, Privacy International, Action on Rights for Children, and we managed to lobby MPs in Parliament. So we would sit down and meet with Nick Gibb, who was then the shadow Education Minister, Sarah Tether, Lib Democrat, Greg Mulholland, Tom Watson, Labour, and we asked some questions in Parliament and spoke to the MPs about getting some sort of change in the Data Protection Act, basically, because the Data Protection Act lists a number of different things like political persuasion, sexuality, ethnicity, whether you're in trade union or not, and that sort of data, you have to give your permission for that data to be processed. So as parents, we are in control of the data that schools process on our kids, and biometric data simply wasn't in that section of the Data Protection Act. So my initial thought was, right, that law needs to be changed. That's, you know, the Act's technically out of date. But what actually happened, you know, and I know you wanted to ask me about this, so I'm going to talk about it anyway. The then Labour government just wouldn't speak to us at all about what was happening in schools with fingerprinting. We've had facial recognition, iris scanning, infrared palm scanning. So basically, because of that loophole in our Data Protection Act, the biometric industry was able to come in and basically test different types of technology for different applications in schools.
It's not illegal, so that's fine.
Yes.
Is there any petition, parents' petition, objecting to facial recognition and iris scanning and fingerprints of the kids? I mean, couldn't we just have parents wanting to sign a petition saying, I want my kid to be educated, but you don't have a right to this ID surveillance?
Good question, Nick. I think the petition system that's online now is far more sophisticated than it was even 5 years ago. So the only thing we could do was use members of parliament. We had, I think, 2 early day motions in parliament. Early day motions are basically when an MP puts an idea forward, lays it in front of the House of Commons, and other MPs sign it if they agree with it. So that's as far as we got with petitions. And there were some Downing Street petitions, I think 3 petitions that were set up. But anyway, to cut a long story short, the Conservative and Lib Dem MPs that we met with did say, sort of prior to 2010, you know, if we get into Parliament in 2010, we'll do something about it. And they did actually get into Parliament and form the coalition. And then in 2011, they put a bill in front of Parliament, which was called the Protection of Freedoms Bill. And in Chapter 2, Clauses 26 to 28, we've got 3 clauses in there, that means that schools, if they want to process fingerprint or any sort of biometric data of children, they have to ask a parent's permission. But not just one parent, they have to be seen to get in touch with both parents. If one parent consents and the other parent doesn't agree with that consent, the non-consent sort of overrides the consent of the parent. And ultimately, if the child, at whatever age, because this is for under 18s, doesn't consent to being fingerprinted or iris scanned or facial scanned, and the parents have consented, the child's non-consent overrides the parent's consent. So that is really good that the emphasis is on the non-consent side of things. However, I personally would like to see this sort of technology not in schools at all. It's completely overkill and not at all proportionate for using, you know, it sends, and I sort of talked about this today, for me, it sends a really subtle psychological message to a child as young as, because they were fingerprinting children as young as 4, that it's okay and it's absolutely fine for, in order for me to feed you, for the school to give you knowledge in the form of library books, for the school to let you be in areas, okay, in order for us to do that, you have to give us your fingerprint.
I think Nick Nomix summed that up in the chat box. He's put fingerprinting kids, etc., is to normalise state intrusion and teach compliance.
He's absolutely right, Nick. Yeah, and one of the reasons us parents, group of parents, worked closely with No to ID. So 10 years ago, they were fighting the biometric identity cards that the Labour government wanted to bring in, was that they saw fingerprinting in school as a very subtle way of educating the next generation or softening the next generation's use to biometrics. So they were a massive help to us. They were great.
But as well as... sorry, Nick, yeah, what...
You describe how in American schools kids have to actually wear around their neck, radio frequency ID things, so they can be, you know, safely tracked wherever they are. This is a more horrendous development, but there isn't any sign of that coming over to England yet, or is there?
Good question, Nick. I mean, one of the first things I did back in 2004 was to look across the state, see how the biometric technology was working in schools over there, and they really weren't doing it at all. It sort of came in 2005 and onwards. But what they were doing, you're absolutely right, is using radio frequency identification devices to place what is known as, so there's two types of RFID devices. You get passive devices like you have in your bank cards or Oyster cards that wake up when you put them near a reader. The reader sends a signal and it wakes up your chip and then exchanges information. Then you get active RFID, which is basically a chip which is emitting a radio frequency device on a pulse every second or 60 seconds, and this is what was being hung around the kids in the States. Really? Is it happening in the UK? Yes, it is, and it has. It happened in a college called West Cheshire College. They started, they were putting ultra-wideband RFID tags, which is military-grade RFID, around the children's necks, emitting 6.35 to 6.75 gigahertz, so a splash of frequency. And they were, this was built into these, the readers were built into a new building. They had a building on Ellesmere Port campus, and they had a West Cheshire College campus. And this, absolutely, they had, the parents weren't aware, the children weren't aware what they had around their neck. And it wasn't until the RFID Journal, which is a big international journal, reported on this. Because what happened was, with the Protection of Freedoms Bill, it got passed in May 2012. And I thought, wow, that's great. Okay, you can have a rest now. And just at that point in time, I don't know if anybody else is aware, but there was a very courageous girl called Andrea Hernandez in the States who had refused to wear an active RFID chip.
I remember reading that.
And so I thought, oh, we've got this bill passed in Parliament, which is great now. Ew, there's nothing in it that covers RFID. So I thought, I wonder if they're doing that in the UK. So I Googled it, and this article from the RFID Journal came up and sort of was spouting on about how great this technology was, and West Cheshire College had been using it for 2 years. And I thought that went completely under everybody's radar. So I started, I basically sent the college a whole load of Freedom of Information requests. We have a Freedom of Information Act, and you can ask establishments questions about how much they wanted to see the letters of consent. I wanted to see what type of technology it was, how much did it cost, how many kids are wearing these things. And the college just couldn't answer me, because they had given these kids these lanyards to wear around their necks, but they were also wearing a dinner card and a something else card, a travel card, so it was sort of hidden by other lanyards, so it wasn't just that lanyard for that purpose. But, yeah, that's a whole other show. We can talk about that.
But, I mean, it's not just compliance, is it? They're gathering a whole shed load of data. What are they doing with the data, do we think?
Well, as far as West Cheshire College went, in the end, because I made myself such a pain for them and they didn't answer the Freedom of Information request, so I got the Information Commissioner's involved, office involved, the Information Commissioner oversees Data Protection Act and the Freedom of Information Act, and I got an article in The Guardian about the technology, because it's the first time this technology has been used in the UK. They switched the system off. 9 months later, the principal, who then retired 3 months after they switched the system off, she got an OBE for services to education. She certainly gave some services to education. But anyway, so yes, you're on about the data collected in schools. So, yes, if anybody's listening, has children or grandchildren, there is, I would do a search engine for the National Pupil Database, because all this data that schools are collecting on children, it's not just educational data, it's data about attendance, what language you speak, all sorts of sort of medical data, you know, maybe what they eat, because this is all being confirmed by biometric fingerprints, and they're storing it on something called the National Children's Database. So the National Children's Database was set up, I think, early 2000, maybe 2001, and it's got nearly over 20 million records on it. So basically, if you're in education in 2001 and you were 18, it will have some of your records on it. So basically, anybody who's just over 30 years old will have their information on this database.
So does it ever get removed?
No, the data never gets removed.
Yep. Coming back to these RFID chips that American, that you said in Cheshire, kids are having to work with, that is very high frequency, 6 gigahertz. Do you have any evidence this might be harmful to their hearts or to their fertility, future fertility, or to their brain function? I know it's hard to get this kind of evidence, but has anyone shown that is safe?
I don't think anybody can show that that is safe. Certainly there was a bioinitiative report that came out, I think, in 2012, where a whole number of sort of scientists and specialists around the world were coming out and saying that radio frequencies are not at all good for humans to be bathed in. So there is no evidence to say that that particular frequency is damaging, but I think that's probably because the work hasn't been done. I think there is more evidence to suggest that bathing ourselves in electromagnetic frequency is relatively unhealthy. So wearing a lanyard, especially for developing girls, you know, around their heart and sort of developing breasts, is something I really seriously wouldn't want any of my children. But I think radio frequency devices in schools is different to biometrics, because you can refuse a biometric, refuse to use biometric technology, or you could also refuse then to not accept an RFID technology. But if your son or daughter is sat next to somebody who is wearing a device, you're still getting the frequency at a fairly sort of, you know, 1 to 2 foot level. So I haven't seen any evidence that this is happening in schools, other than that very isolated incident, which has now been switched off, thankfully.
Probably get turned on again eventually, I would think. Nick's put another good point in there. He's put data retention is key, because he says there'll come a time when folks will start having big problems if they get a false positive biometric match. And of course, false positives, it has been statistically proven, I believe, that by definition, the more accurate tests you get, the more false positives you get. So you can't, and I bet that's manifesting, isn't it?
I think one of the American biometric industry said that the false positives, because you get false positives, which means if you put your fingerprint on a scanner, it will recognise you as somebody else. Or you can get a false negative, which means you put your fingerprint on a scanner and it doesn't recognise you. So I think they think the industry, well, the industry is always going to, I suppose, play the figures on that's going to suit them, that it's about 1 in every 1,000. But if you've got a high school with 1,000 children in, with 1,000 children using biometric fingerprint technology, at least there's going to be one case per day of somebody getting their lunch thinking, the system thinking they're somebody else, or there's somebody being refused a lunch. So that, it's, you know, why can't they, you use a PIN or a swipe card? So in this sense, children and parents, I suppose, because parents now have the say, are abdicating responsibility to the system, to the establishment, to recognise them. Whereas if you have a PIN to remember, or a password, or a card to not you lose, then it's the responsibility is on the child. And I think we should take responsibility for our identification. And schools will say, well, you know, swipe cards can get lost and PIN numbers can be forgotten. What kid has ever forgotten the PIN to his phone, you know? Or, you know, if they can't remember a PIN, how on earth are you going to teach them stuff to pass a GCSE with? That argument doesn't wash whatsoever.
No, it does seem to be a hint of you telling me you can't do your job properly.
Absolutely. And in fact, in West Cheshire College, where they did hang the RFID tags around the necks of the students, there was a promotional video. I have a website called RFIDinschools.com. If you go to the video links there, there's a promotional video by the company called Zebra Technologies. They supplied the system to the school, American company. And on their promotional video, they have somebody from the school saying, well, of course, teachers can't be relied upon to take registration. It's like, well, if they can't be relied on to take registration, how can you rely on them to teach children? It was just bizarre. But that's, the video got taken down from the Zebra YouTube site when I started to ask questions of the school whether or not they'd ask consent from the parents for the RFID. The RFID journal and Zebra Technologies took down all their articles on the RFID that was in the school. Luckily, I'd gone and saved them all as PDFs, so they're on my website, so you can go and read them.
So do you think there's obviously going to be an accumulation of data? Do you think we're going to see some progress in pushing this back from even, well, secondary schools preferably?
I don't think there's any chance, unfortunately, of data collection from children in education. It's a multi-billion pound dollar industry in the States with Common Core. Most children in the UK are now using what they call VLPs, which is virtual learning programs. If you've got a child, they're probably doing their maths homework on it. Children can read books on it. They can do their homework. Quite often homework is virtual, and then children have to go onto the school system and give their homework in. So all this information is logged about when you give the homework in. Maybe if a child is lingering on certain math sums on the programme can identify that the child isn't perhaps finding that very easy. The programmes can log how quickly the child flips a page in a book.
So this is just like those military systems you were talking about earlier, but with children.
Yeah, and what happened in the States, in San Diego, was there was a company, an educational technical company, that approached one school district over there and said, look, we'll supply you with X and thousands of iPads and we'll give you this virtual learning program. So the school district said, brilliant, that's great. Oh, but by the way, this company said, what we're going to do is every 60 seconds facially scan the student so we can check it's that student that's doing it. So this is where the biometrics sort of ties up with virtual learning platforms, because those virtual learning platforms and the data it gives is only good data if it can be absolutely verified that the student that's giving them that data is that student, yeah, not their older sister, their friend that's doing their homework for them, that sort of thing. So, and there's a couple of companies, one's called Newton, spelt with a K, K-N-E-W-T-O-N, and they've got a really interesting YouTube 12-minute clip where the CEO of Newton's, Joseph Ferreira, is saying that children are the most data mined in society, and you know we can get X million pounds of, you know, and it was just, and this was in 2012, so, and this is, we're now in 2016, and Newton's actually came, opened their first UK office in 2013. So this,
you said that Newton's were an adaptive learning company. That doesn't sound very promising either.
So Newton and the educational tech industry's idea is that basically they can collect all this data on how children learn and adapt individual learning programs for each pupil. So for example, Newton state that they can tell if a pupil learns maths best in an afternoon or a morning, whether they learn history best if they've just had a bacon butty, that sort of level of information. So they can tailor different subjects for different pupils for different days, different hours, based on how the artificial intelligence basically is looking at how they're learning.
So they're basically being treated as assets.
Yeah, and there's a massive potential for profiling. You know, it's not just the data they've got on your children or on you. If you're sort of under 30, it's then predicting what that child possibly could do as a career, the sort of level of income they could generate, the sort of taxes they could pay, da-da-da-da-da. You know, if they're logging what they're eating, they can possibly think, okay, well, this child might get this disease in the future, so how is it going to, maybe in 30 years' time, affect whether people can apply for life insurance, whether you get a mortgage for 30 years. We have no idea where this is going to go.
Does this information ever find its way into the hands of the policy enforcement officers?
In the UK, which is really the only country in Europe that's doing this, and the United States, and it's just starting to happen in Australia, we have no evidence to believe that the government is collecting fingerprint information from children, but if police want to access a school fingerprint database, they're entitled to do that under the Data Protection Act, because it will help them solve a crime, and the school and the police don't have to tell the parent or the child that that information has been transferred over to the police national database or police national computer, or IDENT1 as it is or was. Even though the school system will be technically different to the police system, there are programs that make it possible for these two systems to talk to one another. So when a child puts a fingerprint on a fingerprint scanner, it's not an image of the fingerprint that's stored. The computer program looks at the salient points, like the whoops and the swirls of the fingerprint, maps out a little diagram of that, and then will create maybe a 30 or 40 digit number against that. You were completely right in saying the more sophisticated this technology is, the longer the number, the more identifiable that digital biometric identifier is to the child. But once a child has put his fingerprint on that sort of scanner, it could go to the police. It could potentially, and I'm saying this and I've absolutely no evidence, but I guess once it's gone to the police and security services, it then could, in years to come, maybe go to Interpol, Europol. You just have no idea where that data is going to go.
And the data hangs around on the machines, that's the thing. They only seem to be any good at deleting stuff that people might want to actually read. The stuff that people might not want them to have, they don't want to delete that, do they?
This is true. I mean, I was talking about the National Pupil Database earlier, and there's been another mum called Jem Pearson who, just like me, you know, I was just a mum at school, and picking my children up from school, and these technologies sort of get you. But she's actually got a website called defenddigitalme.com. She's done a huge amount of work into the National Pupil Database and the sort of information it stores. She wanted to know from the school what information the school had on her child and where it was going, basically. So the school sort of said, oh, we don't know about the National Pupil Database, but I think what you should do is ask the Department of Education. So she sent a subject access request to the Department of Education. So a subject access request is under the Data Protection Act. You can basically ask on behalf of your child or on behalf of you, any establishment, private or public, what information they have on you. So she issued a subject access request to the Department of Education, asking them what information they had on her child on the National Pupil Database, and they refused it. So, well, I'm going to tell you that. She was like, why aren't you going to tell me that? And apparently...
That's really interesting, because the child, if it's under 16, is her responsibility. She's contracting on its behalf, and they have to tell her, I would have thought.
Well, under Section 33 of the Data Protection Act, if a database is held for research history purposes, then they don't have to release the information that's on that. So what she actually did was, I mean, the information... We sort of worked together a little bit on this, but she's doing the bulk of the work. We think the information goes from school to the local authority. The local authority then sort of filters it through something called the Fisher Family Trust. Fisher Family Trust is a charitable organisation. They organise all the data from all the schools and local authorities into a database. They present that to the Department for Education as a National Pupil Database. So she asked the school what information they had on a child. They couldn't answer her. She asked the Department of Education the information they had on the child. They couldn't answer her. And what she did in the end, she went to the Fisher Family Trust and gave them a subject access request, and because they're not holding it for research or history, they just gave her the information. So really, really poor that...
That's kind of what they're holding the information for, is to market it, isn't it?
Well, the Fisher Family Trust was set up probably about 10 years ago or more, and it was set up by some people that own a company called RM Education. RM Education have been going a few decades, and they are what you call an educational technical company. I think they originally used to supply BBC computers to schools way back when. But of course, the data that's collated from every single school in the UK that they then put into the form of the National Pupil Database, of course they're using it for commercial purposes. They've got all this data coming in from every single school on 9 million school children. And you're not telling me a commercial educational company, a tech company, isn't going to be benefiting from that?
We're surely left only with the conclusion that we don't want our offspring in there, do we? Well,
it was really interesting because I, you know, my children were in primary school. They were nearly fingerprinted at 6 and 7. We let them go to the end of their primary school education, and then I pulled them out. We home educated, and you know what? It was the best thing we ever did. And if you can do it, I would recommend it 100%.
It's one of the things that we really notice going around the festivals, is you can really see the difference between the children who are the offspring who are being home educated and are not being vaccinated, and those that you see in the everyday world.
Completely different. And you're going to learn more from your child not being at school. They can interact with you, adults, society, everyday life. Whereas in school, they're in a box with 30 other 10-year-olds being taught by one adult.
They're in a prison camp.
They are in a prison camp.
It's very... You're in a compliant situation where a bell rings and everybody stands up, walks to another box, sits down, another bell rings, they stand up, walk to another box. You have to put your hand up to go to the toilet. Anyway, that's... I have quite strong views. But having had my children in mainstream education, learnt about the education system and then taken them out... Yeah. And, met some wonderful families and children, and it's just so much more natural for a human being to be educated like that, I feel, anyway.
Yeah. Well, that's brilliant, Pippa. Thank you very much for your time here. It's great because, move yourself from the bands and the bar and all the rest of it to come and chat with us out in the dark on the shadowy edge of the fest. But, Tar, very much for joining us, mate, and for your talk. It was great.
Oh, well, thank you very much. I appreciate you having me here, so thanks.
Well, do hang around. We've got Mobius Loop coming up next, or at least Alec, he's here to talk to us about Hemp Redemption and the band. So we'll play a couple of tunes whilst we shuffle around in here, thanks to Pippa. This is, of course, Dr. Rock's radio show on raconteursnews.com. And this is Rob Heron and the Teapad Orchestra.
At this point, there is about 90 seconds of the original broadcast missing because the good doctor failed to unmute his microphone, unfortunately. During these 90 seconds, he was introducing Alex and Katie from Mobius Loop, who we referred to earlier in the show. He'd been playing some fantastic music over the last couple of weekends. And he'd been asking Alex how it was that the band came about and how long they'd been playing and stuff. We don't miss much of Alex's answer because by that stage the doctor did notice that the little red lights were flashing. So he pressed the button and Alex is talking about a crop circle they encountered around the time that they were getting the band together and seeking for a name for the band. So now, back to the live broadcast. Thank you for your attention.
Because we live in the internet age, we were able to find out about it the same day. And I'd been looking for a band name all that time ago, like 8 years it's coming up to. What's the date today?
It's the 6th.
Exactly 6th? It's 8 years in 2 days. Yeah. It's the anniversary of discovering that crop circle, calling it Mobius Loop, and then actually the lyrics and the way we've started to, our lifestyles have formed and stuff. It's all been really inspired by, you know, the alignment of two sides and what it means for everything to be infinite, you know.
Yeah.
So it's been a real catalyst. That was a great catalyst, and it was also to do with the, you know, our collective lives, our lives on Earth, because of the alignments and numbers and the fact that the mysterious nature of these crop circles as well. You know, it was all really great inspiration for a band. Yeah.
And you seem to me to be pretty close together as a group of people. Have you been kind of living and gigging? Has it been a sort of standard living in a condominium and going out and gigging in pubs?
It's been a development from pubs, open mics it started off as, and then, well, no, actually, it started off as jamming around a table, then open mics, then into pubs and clubs and trying to find where we wanted to go. And then after about 5 years of doing that and living in squats in London and skipping out of the bins there and, you know, trying to be radical but trying to be accepted as well. You know, try and find an audience. After a while, someone said, why aren't you doing festivals? After about 5 years. And that was George Spittle of Familiar Ghost, a good friend of ours in Linden St. Anne's, who might be listening. And he said, why aren't you doing festivals? And we didn't know what they were. And we went to one. I think it was Beat Herder in Lancashire. And we just found our home there, really, and started finding people like you, man. And it's difficult to link with your tribe, you know. In the cities, people are so down and out with their jobs, and you know, out here in the festivals, it's like we're in another realm. And
So
the band, the development of the band ended up going from strength to strength once we hit the festival circuits in the UK, and that's led to us now living on a co-op in Wales.
Yeah, you're living at the Chicken Shack, aren't you?
Yeah, the Chicken Shack co-op, it's amazing. We're so blown away. We've only been there 3 or 4 months. We found it, it was just like a blessed unfolding, and it was in time with Katie and I. Obviously we needed a nest for Gemini to be born, and that was at a period we just toured Europe this year in February. We did 8 countries, and then we came back in March, we did the UK, and then in April we found the Chicken Shack and just laid to rest there, and in June had a free birth, which Katie might like to talk to you about. Quickly, maybe.
No, that's it. We'll catch up with you again when you haven't got a band to go and see. But we've mentioned Chicken Shack a fair bit on the show because Steve Jones has been on and chatted with us. People will remember him.
We went to see him. What an inspiration Steve Jones is. We went to visit him just before we got accepted onto Chicken Shack, and he gave us an extra push really at the idea, because we was nipping from our hometown of Preston in Lancashire to go and check it out, see if it was a good place for us. And when we realised it was, we're just blown away by the permaculture that's available out there on the land that everyone can go and achieve, you know.
And it is actually a functional community that's been there for the best part of 20 years or so, is it now?
Yeah, it's the 21st year this year. It was 1995. They celebrated it last summer. Yeah, Steve Jones.
And is it still working well? Is it still a friendly place to be? Have they kind of got their personal intercommunications and emotional garbage under control?
It is very much under control, yeah. It's a really peaceful place to be. And it's very, like, inspiring for us to have arrived at a place where we're just learning every day off the people who were there. And there's no vibes or anything that needs sorting out. Everyone's just really open arms, welcoming. Really like trying to have collective meals together every other night, growing food together, sharing the garden, talking about how to grow this vegetable, that vegetable, when to harvest. It just really takes up all the positive vibes, and uses it as a catalyst for progression of the site, you know. That's what we want to help achieve, is just for more blossoming. Like, we know how to build yurts, the Mobius loop. We've been taught how to do that by some wonderful teachers in Lancashire, and that's something that we'd like to pursue and help others learn to do. Like, you've seen them, haven't you? They're here.
Yeah, I've seen them.
Great for off-grid living. Yeah.
So is that where you do you live in the yurts at the Chicken Shack, or do you have apartments?
We have Mobius Loop share a cottage together, and we have yurts on the land as well. And we use the yurts to host Hemp Redemption at festivals and at other events, whatever event it may be.
That's really good, isn't it? Because it means you can work on the band, you can work on the Hemp Redemption in a very sympathetic atmosphere. It must make it easier to make the transition to festivals and back again. Must be a good place to go back to.
It's a new experience for us, because we've always gone back to a city from tours. So going back to a permaculture site on the west coast of Wales, you know, just miles from anywhere, it is a wonderful feeling and a great addition to the energy we're trying to build for performances, live performances.
Yeah, sounds pretty perfect. And you're not far away from us, really, so we will be able to catch up with you again, and we'll be able to do more stuff together, hopefully. Because we got on, Katie and I, certainly from the moment we started chatting, it was like we had so many interests in common. So I'm really looking forward to spending a bit more time with you. But before we release you to go and listen to the Turbans, what about the Hemp Redemption? Surely it's just a weed, isn't it?
Well, yeah, I suppose that's what our education tells us, eh? It's a naughty weed.
How long have you been a kind of proponent of it for health and fitness?
I was thinking about this the other day, because it's been a part of our like lifestyle for a while now, as a nutritional and an inspirational sort of plant. And it was like back in 2010, Mobius Loop went on tour of London in a caravan, all painted up with love and music and stuff written all over his caravan. And it was a good idea, but also a bad idea, because it ended with, you know, being quite tired come 6 months. But within that time, we met some wonderful people who were, you know, talking about using hemp in a really positive way. They're called Amaru, and they were bringing it from a farm. They were friends with abroad, bringing it here, and that triggered the initial like understanding about it. So like 2010 that was, but only 2 years ago did we start actually trying to host an event based around it. So that was, you know, a good 4 years later.
After
meeting those people, yeah.
So what was the first event you did? How did it wash out?
It was at a workers' co-op in Preston called The Beautiful Planet, wonderful place. If you're ever in Preston, Lancashire, you want to connect with the sort of tribes that are at festivals, go to The Beautiful Planet in Preston on Friargate. It's a workers' co-op and an amazing, inspiring place.
We ran it as a jam night, didn't we?
Yeah.
It started out as like a jam night, so everyone would tune to a key and then everyone could jam along, no matter whether they consider themselves musical or not. It'd all be a big jam at the end of the night. So this is like what we built it around, this free-flowing vibe, and then obviously promoting hemp education and hemp foods and hemp hot chocolates, and just trying to get people to consume hemp, because it's just proper good for us nutritionally. And it was a proper amazing event, wasn't it?
Yeah.
And then the next event we did it after that was Audio Farm Festival in Wales, and that was absolutely amazing as well. That's when we hosted it in a yurt, and we served hemp smoothies, and amazing. And we'd just done another festival, Audio Farm Festival, a few weeks ago, wasn't it? And we did our Hemp Redemption there, and a great amazing bunch of people. And that's a vegan festival, which is what really inspired us to get right into the hemp, wasn't it? Was those guys went vegan and really started eating hemp every day and feeling absolutely amazing from the nutrition it was giving us. And that was
is that our main interest in it, the nutrition, or does it do other things for us as well? I know it is full of nutrition, isn't it?
Well, we use it as like a sacramental herb, and we call upon its wisdom when we're writing music and stuff like this, and when we just want to, you know, think about a subject matter. Yeah, it's when you smoke it, it can do wonderful things, you know.
We also promote the infinite uses of hemp. Obviously, as you guys know, the revolutionary uses for hemp. You know, we should be growing it everywhere, and we should be using it for clothes, fuel, medicine. We all know the infinite uses of hemp. Yeah, I hope you're just trying to
hempeline. It can be a biodiesel. It can be a paint. It can be a fibre. It can be a plastic. It can be a hempcrete. You're absolutely right. And there's research out there that is really not being considered, you know, revolutionary, really. When there's so much pollution going on and that's being reported. Oh, yeah, the AFA doesn't recognise hemp as a food source right now.
Or as a building product either. Yeah. It's funny, isn't it? Because in Elizabethan times, if you had over a given amount of land, you were expected to put an acre of it over to hemp, otherwise they'd fine you for it. They don't seem to have very consistent standards, do they? Well, that's really grand. Like I say, we'll have a chance to catch up with you. I know you'd like to get back out there into the fresh air. So yeah, thanks very much, Alex and Katie. And Jemai for coming.
Yeah.
No, he's well crashed out. Not a problem. So your time here is done. Thank you very much. I think you'll hopefully be on Dr. Rock's radio show again.
We can't wait.
Really brilliant.
Wonderful thing. We're learning so much from you, man. Yeah, this is great.
Thank you very much. I'm learning from you as well. That's brilliant. So I'm going to put on another of your tunes. I'm going to put on Zen.
Brilliant.
By Mobius Loop. As these lucky people get to head off for the bar and the bands, and we selfless people will be sitting here doing you service through to about midnight. We've got John, the captain or colonel of Pentos TV, the man who's running the talk space we're all working in here. And we've got Adrian Gilbert as well, which is a tremendous privilege to talk about the Stone of Scone and various other things, about which I knew very little actually until I listened to Adrian. So we'll play this tune. We'll be back with you in about 5-8 minutes or so. And you are, of course, listening to Dr. Rock's radio show on raconteursnews.com. Coming live from afield, because this is the 21st century and we're glad to be here. And that one there. And that was Sheila Nagig. And where's Ralphie? Who knows where Ralphie is? Well, big thanks there to Alex and Katie for coming in. I'm sure, as I say, we're going to be hearing plenty more from them, because I think we'll be working with them as the weeks go by. It'll give us somewhere to go over the winter. Hey, Synchro, we'll be able to go up to the Chicken Shack and meet some good people. So now I'm joined by Adrian Gilbert, which is really great, because it's I think it was the Orion mystery Adrian worked on with Beauval, and I really enjoyed that. I suspect I've read others of your stuff as well, but welcome to Dr. Rock's radio show, and what are you talking to us about this year?
Well, I've just been talking about the Stone of Destiny, otherwise known as the Stone of Scone, or the Lea Fail, or the Pharaoh's Stone. Now, not many people know it has the name the Pharaoh's Stone, but I found that in the Irish Annals, and it connects with the idea that this stone, which I don't know if you know this, but it's actually kept underneath the coronation seat, or it used to be, till John Major, for reasons unknown, decided that he was going to send it back to Scotland.
It's a shame you said for reasons unknown, because, of course, when did it actually arrive under the throne? How long had it been there before John Major decided to send it to Scotland?
Well, I believe it was brought back to England in 1296. And yes, you're right. He sent it back to Scotland 700 years later in 1996. So 700 years.
Do you think we'll ever find out why he did that? Or do you think it'll ever come back? I mean, it just seems a really strange thing to do, because it's a constitutional part of England, isn't it?
Well, there's so much one can say about this. I mean, I think the reason he did it was he thought that he would pacify the Scottish nationalists if he did that. You know, here's a crumb for you, don't sort of leave the Union. But what he actually did in effect was to take the guts out of the throne and send it back to Edinburgh. Okay, but it's not part of the Scottish, it's not in the Assembly building or anything, it's actually in a little museum in Edinburgh Castle. So basically what's happened is that this stone, which has tremendous meanings at all sorts of levels, is now being treated as a museum exhibit. It belongs in the past. It's no longer relevant. Yeah. It's just something discarded. And I think that is quite shocking.
I just wonder, just occurred to me whether it's possible that if we leave Europe, we might get it back again. I was wondering whether it was something to do with the loss of sovereignty that, as a nation, we experienced.
I think you're absolutely spot on there. I mean, for a start, sending it back didn't pacify the Scottish nationalists. It accelerated the whole process to the point where Scotland has almost left the United Kingdom. But yes, the whole question about sovereignty and the importance of Britain or British identity and the sense that we have of our own will expressed through our democracy has been put very much at risk. I mean, I don't know about... I know a lot of people listening probably were Remainers and sort of rue the day that people voted for us to leave the European Union. But I would ask them to ponder this, that it took us centuries to win our democracy. You know, we've had wars, we had Magna Carta, we had chopping the head off Charles I, we had, James II being booted off the throne and William III coming along in a great sort of act of Parliament to establish our sovereignty of our democracy. And then people come along and they're quite willing to hand it away to unelected bureaucrats in Brussels, taking decisions on our behalf. We can't get rid of those bureaucrats. We can't dismiss the president of the commission. And yet they have total control over us. It's like saying, yes, please be my lord and master, And had we voted to remain, we would have been doing this willingly, whereas it had been done by subterfuge before. It wasn't our fault. It had been sneaked in on us. And thank God that we had the guts, enough of us, to stand up and say, enough is enough, we're not having this.
I'm really hoping that was the first time I've ever seen a vote that I actually felt I could even vaguely approve of the result of, and I'm hoping it's the start of mould-breaking behaviour. Do you think we'll see more of it?
Well, I think the mould is already breaking all over the place, isn't it? But you see, the Stone of Destiny is not just any old stone. And I've been giving a talk this evening here at the Harlequin Fair talking about how this stone actually has mathematics built into it, if you know how to look for it. And I connect it. There's a story from the time of before the pyramids were built that King Khufu, or Cheops, wanted to build a pyramid, and he turned to his secretary and he said, look, I want to put in the numbers of Thoth. Can you find out what they are for me? and he said, I don't know myself, but you can find them in the temple at Heliopolis, in a room called Revision. There's a box there. You'll find them in that. Right?
Go on, Nick.
Well, this stone has got fairly simple arithmetic ratio in the length of its side, 3, 5, and 7. Isn't that a fairly normal kind of brick shape?
Well, it's not normal. I mean, it's... The whole process of this stone is that you can tie strings around it in three directions, and from those construct a triangle, and it's a very special triangle with sides 5, 7, and 8, and from that you can drop verticals. I can't tell you how to do this on air very easily, but the stone...
It's one at right angles from the hypotenuse going into the left-hand corner, I think. That'll work it for you.
Anyway, to cut a long story short, using this construction, you can very easily square the circle, and from that you can produce a pi pyramid, which is what the Great Pyramid of Cheops is, of course.
And squaring the circle is the big geometer's mystery, isn't it? It's one of those tricks. If you, not many people could do it, and there it is in the Great Pyramid. Amazing.
Yeah. I mean, the whole idea of squaring the circle is actually, it's a symbol for spirit and matter, because circles represent spirit and squares represent matter. So it's a union of spirit and matter is what's being expressed through the pyramid.
Yeah.
And that, of course, was one of the great mysteries.
I believe you told us in your talk, Adrian, that the stone originally arrived in Ireland and thence was transferred to Scotland and thence came down to England. But maybe we don't have any real evidence, or do we, of where it was before Ireland? And aren't you being rather conjectural in talking about Egypt now?
Well, we have the evidence of the Irish annals, which tell us that it was brought to Ireland from Egypt. Now, you might dismiss those, but I think, history means remembering the past. And it's not the same as archaeology. Archaeology is trying to work out the past from doing detective work. But there's also what people remember. And that what they remember is what they've written down in their history. And they tell us that they came from, or they had waves of invaders that came to Ireland. And at least one of these was connected with the Middle East and with the past. And the Scots also have the same legend about the Scythian migration that came from Egypt. Now, that seems very odd until you investigate more deeply and you find out there were actually Scythians working in Egypt as mercenaries for the Pharaoh. So it's, and they got booted out. So it makes kind of sense that way as well. But the whole Irish thing I find absolutely fascinating.
So where did the Scythians come from? What were they doing working as mercenaries for the ancient Egyptians?
Well, when you read Herodotus, he tells us how a Scythian army descended on the capital of the Medes, the Medo-Persians, and they sacked the capital there. And for a short time, they dominated the Middle East, and then they were defeated. So it's the remnant of that Scythian army who then went to Egypt because they thought that that might be a good place to get some booty.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
The Pharaoh, instead of fighting them, he employed them.
Yeah.
He needed some strong horsemen on his side, so he gave him a job. So these are the kind of the nodules of history which you won't find in archaeology because it doesn't always record who is who and what they did. It just shows you houses or buildings or bits and pieces.
Could I possibly ask Jonathan here? We've got a proposal of this stone, amazing history, that Irish documents say it came from Egypt. But why would Egyptians want to take a stone over to Ireland? And isn't that a rather long way to travel?
Well, as an amateur student of history and archaeology, what can I say? Flights, perhaps? Were they fleeing something? I'm on it.
Well, the Irish annals actually tell us about several migrations. One of them they call the Tuatha De Danann. Yeah. Now, when you look in standard texts on history, they tell you the Tuatha De Danann are the people who worship the goddess Danae. No. The Tuatha De Danann means the tribe of Dan, and that's one of the 12 tribes of Israel. And we know that that when Israel was being attacked by the Assyrians, the tribe of Dan actually lived on the coast where Tel Aviv is now. And if you were living on the coast and there's this great big army of Assyrians coming along who are going to do God knows what to you, what would you do? I know what I would do. I'd get in my boat. I'd get the hell out of there. Because they were a trading tribe. So they would have had known people all over the Mediterranean and probably over to the British Isles as well.
Yeah.
So it makes sense.
I think it probably is a very, very important question as to why the Egyptians might have chosen to move this particular stone. But it does seem to me that there's evidence that there was something of a diaspora of stuff generally from Egypt and people at that time. And along those lines, there's a question in the chat box from Midrin saying, was anything else brought over here with the stone, do we think?
Well, before I go on to that, let me just say that the stone itself is measured in half Egyptian cubits, right? An Egyptian cubit is 22 inches. 21 inches, and a half a cubit is 10.5 inches. And curiously, the Egyptians were using units of measure almost exactly the same as the traditional British units that we have in our metrology.
Yeah.
What did they bring with them? Well, there's all sorts of stories about a princess being brought to Ireland from Egypt. Now, the reason why she was a Jewish princess. The reason why she was there was this was actually slightly later, the time of the Babylonians, when they were sacking Jerusalem. Jeremiah the prophet, and we're told this in the Bible, he took the princesses of the royal house to Egypt. And the princes had all been put to death by the Babylonians, and the king was blinded and taken away to Babylon. He's the last king of Judah. But the princesses survived, and the story goes that Jeremiah the prophet took this princess, and very likely the stone as well, to Ireland. And she married the king of Ireland. And from them were descended the Irish kings. Then later on there's a second migration that came there. Of the Scots, the Scutae, who joined with them, and then they all went, or some of them anyway, to Scotland and took the stone there. So it's, you know, we're looking into a mixture of history, fact, knowledge, mythology, dimensions, pyramids, you know, it all ties in together. But the fact is that Britain is some kind of very special place. And if we turn our back on our history and just abuse it by selling out to unelected bureaucrats in Brussels, that is just a sin, in my opinion.
Yeah. Kingston is where the kings of England were crowned, I was told. I'd like to ask if you'll confirm that. Has that got anything to do with the King's Stone? Is this in any way part of the story? And can you give us just a rough idea how many centuries this stone was involved in the crowning of the kings of England?
First of all, the stone that we're talking about, the Stone of Destiny, was in Scotland until from about 530 till about 1296, right? And then it was taken by Edward I to England. Now, the King's Stone, Kingston on Thames, that was where the Saxon kings were crowned. And about five or six of them, I think, that were crowned there. So it's a totally different stone. But there are other royal stones around, you know. There's Athelstone, which was outside Salisbury. I think the point is, with a stone, what they were used for was to witness things that you were doing. And it wasn't only stones that were used that way. Graves were used that way. For instance, you probably know that Westminster Abbey was founded by Edward the Confessor. And when Edward the Confessor died, is what provoked the Norman invasion of Britain. But what the Norman king, William, did is he had himself crowned in front of Edward's tomb, showing that Edward was his witness, that Edward had promised the throne to him, although he wasn't a descendant. He had no right to the throne at all. But he was making use of Edward's promise. And since then, nearly all kings of England have been crowned in Westminster Abbey in front of Edward's tomb, because they're drawing on that same thing, that this is my right because he had the right and he had the right, and it went back to Edward the Confessor.
That's well shaky, isn't it? We get to see plenty of that in Shakespeare's history plays as well, these kind of dodgy handing on of crowns and all that kind of stuff. You were making a connection in your talk as well between this stone and the Ark of the Covenant. Would you like to tell us a bit about that?
Now, a lot of people are fascinated by the Ark of the Covenant. I suppose since the Indiana Jones film, you know, Raiders of the Lost Ark. But what you have to remember is the Ark itself was just a box. It's a box for carrying things around. It's like your suitcase. You know, where's Moses' suitcase gone? Yeah. So what's really important is what was inside the Ark. And, of course, what we're told in the Bible was inside the Ark was the tablets of the law that Moses brought down from Mount Sinai. And these are documents. And again, they're stones of witness. They're witnessing a promise made by God to Moses. You might not believe in God, you might not believe in the promise. This is what these stones are supposed to represent. Yeah. And so they're very precious, because they're, you know, it's like the contract you have signed on your house, your deeds, you know.
Can I just ask, Lawrence Gardner, in one of his books, opened a bit of a can of worms in the idea of investigating the powers that the Ark was supposed to possess. It's been talked about as a super weapon and something kind of almost bordering on quantum mechanics. Do you have any ideas about that?
Yes, I do. The whole point about the Ark was it was meant to be the throne of God. It has a mercy seat on it that God can sit on. Now, what is God, or what is a God, or what is a manifestation of God? And you're told in the Bible that it could manifest as a column of fire, for instance, or smoke, and leading people along. But if you think about a ball of plasma, right, that could manifest sitting on top of the Ark, that would have some dangerous qualities to it. It'd be like ball lightning.
Yeah.
So there can be something to do with that.
Well, I know there was a fascinating article in 14 Times when they looked at the design of the Ark of the Covenant and suggested that it might be a static charge generator, and that the tabernacle that went over it, which is described in exhaustive detail, isn't it? With different sorts of silk and gold, round cedar wood and all of that. The suggestion there was that the shifting of all of these different cloths in the desert wind and stuff would act, because it had a pair of wings, didn't it? Have a couple of angels on top of it, the Ark. That's right, and then a chain going from the top to contact the bomb. So it did seem to me, it seemed like a fairly good argument that it was a charge device, which if you got too close to it might well just leave you with a pair of smoking boots, which is after all what the Ark's reported to have done to people, isn't it?
Well, I mean, one thing you can say about the Ark, and I'll say this briefly because there's something else I want to tell you, is the Ark was covered with gold.
Yes.
Right? Now, you put gold out in sunlight, and you'll get a very strong static charge build-up. So it's quite possible if someone touched this, they would get a nasty electric shock, which could possibly even kill them.
I mean, that, I think, if I remember rightly, and it's a bit of a while since I read it, one of the first experiences we have of the Ark being active was where one of Moses' brother's priests, what was his name, Aaron, one of the priests working with Aaron, dropped some incense somewhere a little bit beyond a line, too close to the Ark, went to pick it up, and we did get to see a pair of smoking boots. Are my memories correct there?
Yeah, so you can imagine if you got this Ark and there's a strong charge on it, that it could zap you.
Yeah.
So I mean, that would just be the protection. But what matters is what's inside.
Yeah.
And one of the things I was going to say...
It's protecting what the contents of the box.
Yes, of course. And so one of the things I was going to say is that the dimensions of the Ark are measured in cubits. And the top of it is 1.5 by 2.5 cubits. And the depth is 1.5 cubits. The Stone of Destiny is measured in half cubits, and the top is 1.5 by 2.5 cubits, so it's the same shape, and it's not quite as deep as the Ark. It's only one half cubit deep, so it's 2/3 the depth. But you can imagine that if you come out of Egypt, right? Let's say this stone was in Egypt originally. I was talking about the pyramid and how Khufu wanted the numbers and so on. So say they nicked it, right, and stick it in the box to carry it.
Make off with it.
Yeah.
Yeah?
And then it becomes the throne of the kings of Israel. And then later on it gets transferred to Ireland, and then to Scotland, and then to England.
One can't help wondering if some sort of kingship is moving with it.
Yeah.
Not that we're likely to find that out in the immediate future. So, I mean, are you going to write a book about this, or are there places where people can go to find out a bit more about it?
Well, I've actually already written a book called Secrets of the Stone of Destiny, but it's not been published in Britain. It's published in America, but I think you can probably get it over here. It's published by the ARE, that's the Edgar Cayce Foundation.
Oh,
yeah. So if anyone's interested, you can get hold of it through them.
And do you have a website that people can find you on and catch up on your present work?
At the moment, I'm not running a website, but I do have a Facebook. And if you look up Asian Gilbert 1, I think it is, on Facebook, you can find me that way.
Brilliant. Well, that's great, Adrian. Thank you very, very much for joining us on Dr. Rocket. So that was a real unexpected surprise and a privilege. I really enjoyed your talk as well. It's one of these subjects that I think we all know a little bit about, and it's really great to see somebody joining so many dots. So thanks very much for your time. You're hanging around tomorrow, and
I might pop in a bit in the morning, but I shall see.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, thank you anyway.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much. Well, I'm going to Darren's turned up. He's Darren. Oh, Christopher. Nay, Darren. He's remembered that he's due here. So knee. Yeah, knee. So he's drawn at us out of the dark. I'm going to play a quick Horace X tune, then we'll have a quick chat with Darren, and then it'll be time for us to go and see some bands. So here's M equals EC squared from Horace X, as you know, one of the Doctor's favourite bands. Horace X there, and M equals EC squared. Which one needs turning down? That one needs turning down. Hopefully you can still hear me. Yes, you can. Absolutely brilliant. Got all the knobs under control. It's a little black box, you see, with no lights on it, and it's dark in here. This makes it a lot more of a risky process. But we are using our raconteursnews.com 12-volt battery tonight for the first time, so we are genuinely 12-volt, genuinely open source. And talking of genuinely open source, I have with me the fabulous now Christopher DOG. Thanks for joining us, Christopher, or Darren. I'm going to have to call you Darren.
That's all right, you're allowed to. Yes, you're in the cohorts that were with me in that world in life, so yeah. And it is just my middle name anyway, so yeah. I've just shifted, yeah.
That's great.
I'm in process.
So I know you want to say, before, I'd like to talk a little bit about your spelling talk that you did earlier on, and we'll catch up with you on the Indigenous Mind at some point as well, but I think you wanted to make some comments about the Ark, didn't you, after our last conversation?
Yeah, I just came in at the end there, and it's just, you know, a language spelling thing really, isn't it? And it is that we've just assumed that because Noah had an Ark and... you know, the Ark is mentioned elsewhere, that we're talking about, you know, specifically the box. Like you say, it's been very well described, but it's a word with more than one meaning, really. And if we are talking about an object of charge, which we are, then it's also the way in which people would be turned into smoking boots, as you put it, would be by an Ark. So there would literally be an ARC of charge, an Ark of charge would be coming out, and that would be the method by which somebody else would see you be touched by the Lord. Yeah, lucky you.
Yeah, lucky you indeed. Yeah, it's funny that that's interesting, isn't it? Because you were pointing out earlier on, we've got, so as we'll get into in a bit, there's so many words associated with sound, but there's actually a lot of words associated with electricity as well, isn't there? Percept, ion, the concept, ion, they're everywhere. Do you want to have a go at that?
Oh my goodness me, that's where it's at. And the crossover word, the word that bridges the two, is the word conduct.
Yes.
Conduct is the one thing that you're accountable for and responsible for, nothing else. You know, everybody can chuck whatever they want at you, but essentially, as far as I can tell, the only thing the world around us is interested in is how we master our conduct, which is a cross of sound and how we take charge, which is how we handle the charge moving through us, which you could really call a personal covenant, really, because if we don't get it right, we arc out and turn people around as into smoking boots.
Plenty of smoking boots in the world nowadays, that's for sure. So you're basically, today you've been talking about spelling and words, which I think, because we've only got 10 minutes or so, we'll concentrate on. It's something we touch on a lot on the show. And it is that by using words, we change the world outside us. And that's the most important thing, isn't it?
Not just the world outside us, the world inside us as well. As soon as you refine or change your understanding of something, then, yeah, you're literally changing the world. You're kind of pulling yourself along in the world of meaning as you get deeper and deeper into, I suppose, you know, mysteries of yourself and the world.
I was thinking about that because I talk about dealing with people. If you respond to somebody peacefully, they're going to be a lot more happy than if you respond to them angrily. And their whole physical system, their hormonal system, is going to be sending them different signals depending on how you approach it. But one of the things you said today which really struck me is that some of these spells can hang around for years. And I thought back to an art teacher who gave me a real kicking once because he'd given me some instructions and he felt that in my work of art I hadn't actually followed the instructions. So he just trashed me basically, and I didn't paint anything else until I was 36.
That is what I'm talking about. That's exactly it. This is that power of spelling where people treat themselves so poorly because of words somebody said just once, you know. And Yeah, I see people, myself included, you know, wrestling with poor treatment of self and poor opinion of self, poor sense of value, just because of stuff that people have said to me and treated me. And it's like, it's interesting, you know. Yeah, again, part of mastering conduct is learning that people's actions in relation to you aren't really about you, it's about them.
This is one of the things, isn't it? I think one of the most basic things is that people don't seem to realise that they can only understand other people's behaviour through their own mental furniture. So whatever it is you see is a reflection of yourself.
Yeah. That is it. It's about frame of reference, that one. It's a really interesting one, that, because... it's about vision, and there's an interesting thing in groups, because as we were talking earlier in the spelling talk, you can tell when somebody is on the same page as you, and you can tell when there might be a little bit of work to be done there, and just an interesting thing about how we meet in the minds there.
So if we're going to if we're aware that the words we speak are spells and that they affect people, it becomes even more important that we spell well, doesn't it? How can we do that for people?
Well, I mean, what you've got to realise, this is a really interesting thing. So, if you are angry and you are touching your keyboard, your computer, say as an example, because I see one before me, in front of me, how do you actually touch the keyboard with anger? Where does the anger have to go first?
Through your heart.
Has to go through you.
Yeah.
So basically, you're inflicting that rigidity and that tension in your... It has to go through you first,
yeah,
before it can touch the world. And it's the same with your spelling. It has to go through you first. So it goes through you first before it goes anywhere else. And that's the thing. It's like, it can't get to the world outside you without moving through you first.
Well, the spell, like everything else, is the thing, and the idea comes before the thing, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. It does. I mean, most people don't actually stop to think before they speak. A lot of them don't stop to think before they act, and it's normal. That's natural. It's like, you know, we've all got body gestures that we use. You know, we've all got different things. You know, like at the minute, my hands waddling about the place. None of you are bothered by it because everybody has these sort of mannerisms. It's like. I lost my thread again there.
Although it's late. It's 11 o'clock. It's 11 o'clock, Saturday night.
In terms of the spelling side of it, I'd like to actually just get to the biggest spell. If we've only got a couple of minutes, I'd just like to get on to the biggest stuff. Because really, the spelling stuff that we're talking about here is about remapping the world that matches experience. So that's what I'm talking about here. This is how we heal our mind in relation to the one that we were given, and that's the spelling work that I was talking about today. But the real stuff, like tomorrow's stuff, the return to Indigenous mind, that's like fundamental mental healing, as far as I'm concerned. It's the missing link for the change to come, and it is about how we take charge, and it's about what's getting in the way of the embodiment of people's charge for change, their desire for the world to change. People have the mental charge, they have the emotional charge. However, getting that to translate well into the body is where it's at. This is what embodiment is. This is where the problem is, because we've got this disease in the West that's mental disembodiment. So I'll give you some examples of this mental disembodiment. So people talk about visiting nature. It's like, okay, show me somewhere on this planet that isn't nature.
Actually, the very use of the word nature implies separation.
Exactly. There's a number of spells like this where we don't realise, we literally spell our doom, our separation. Words like, even to have words like spiritual is almost deadly, yeah, because you're implying there's something that isn't.
Yes.
Or to refer to the divine. It's like, well, unless I'm including myself in that, then I have stuck myself outside of that. Yeah.
And this fundamentally is the founding reference that allows us to abuse our bodies and desecrate the world.
That's exactly it, and it is exactly it. That is the visitor mind, because it's not attached to the consequences. And when people are talking about all their ideas of aliens and all the rest of it, it is an alien mind, but it doesn't mean necessarily. And it's an alien mind because it's a visitor. Because, I mean, the Toltecs actually wrote about this secretly for years as the parasite. And you'll read Don Miguel Ruiz talking about it as the parasite. And what does the parasite do? It tricks you into thinking it's you. And yet this parasite will talk to you as you. It will hijack all your ideas of spirituality and all the rest of it to make you believe that you're a visitor here. It'll talk about visiting nature. It'll refer to Indigenous people without referring to yourself. it'll view the earth as dirty. You know, you ask any earthling or any earth animal whether the earth is dirty, the substance of the earth itself, and yet we measure civilization and purity as the measure of how far away you've pushed the earth. I mean, this is powerful stuff, you know. This is the problem here. We're creating an alien mind.
And because we're behaving like that and that's the way we're thinking, we're manifesting leaders that absolutely support that kind of illusion.
Well, no, the problem we've got is all of the people, almost without exception, who consider themselves genuine change agents of the real change, none of them go for the jobs. That's what the problem is. None of them are going for the jobs. That's all it is.
The thing is that whilst we've got people in there who are going to sideline you and shoot you if you're a whistleblower and that sort of stuff, nobody would actually want the job, would they, in fairness? I mean, what Simon Spaniard says is our problem is that we're not holding to account the people who have the jobs.
This is the problem, though, and the problem, and the thing here, this is what I discovered with the People's Public Trust in the work with the Master Title, was exactly that, which is why I backed out of that arena, because I recognised the problem was not with the employees of the state, the problem was with me. It was about my ability to manage my state. That was the problem, you know, and until I can take charge of my state, then it's me not standing in my power that is the problem. It's got nothing to do with these totally mentally ill, demented people that think they've got special powers around me, yeah. Right? It's like, yeah. You know, I'm the responsible one, so it's like, they genuinely think that putting on their clothes gives them special powers. Yeah. It's a mental distortion.
Yeah, you realise how crazy that makes you sound?
It is, exactly. Yeah. It's like, I put on these clothes, I have special powers. Okay, right. That's why they give them cars with sirens on, so you know to stay away. warning, yellow and tagging. Yeah.
So in the couple of minutes or so we got left before I play Little Jewish Princess by Frank Zappa. How can we best and swiftly improve our spells?
Massively. Okay, first of all, I just want to say as well that while I jested about the police there, I know many fine workers in the police force. You know, there's agents of good and evil in all lines of work. The point here is, you know, this idea of taking charge and embodying the charge for change. That's what the issue is. People standing in their power are effective. That's what it boils down to. People ranting and demanding with a sense of entitlement, but still being disembodied, are just running in circles, to be quite honest. So here's how we do it. What you've got to do is you've got to heal this disconnection, and the disconnection lies in the shape of your mind. You know, it's a really interesting thing, and it's at the roots of sense of worth, value, all that sort of stuff. And it's about our basic shapes. You know, it's all this original stuff we were talking about the basic shapes. If you were taught that triangles, circles and squares were the basic shapes, you've got this mental disconnection built in, because those are not natural shapes. Our shapes become characters. The characters we build into spells, the spells we use to express our innermost yearnings and our highest aspirations. And if the building blocks we've been given are disconnected and disjointed from the minute we've been given them, then everything we build with them will be disconnected and disjointed. Until you fix the framework itself, that is the rat in the maze of the mind. So the mind is actually, it's become the bad boy in recent years, but really, it's frantic to integrate. It's desperate to get to fully embody and integrate, and that's why it's so busy. That's why it's so agitated. It is desperate to break into embodiment and become the felt mind, the indigenous mind, the embodied mind that is present in the now.
Yeah. And that's because we need to get on with each other and not be separated from each other fundamentally. So we need to be seeking not only the unity with ourselves, but with other people too.
Yes, but the point is that it has to start with yourself first. This is the big key, and this is the basic shape we're talking about. This is where it all knits together. The gender work, the sound work, the sovereignty work, and the shape work all knit together on this specific point. And it's why the men are collared. You know, it's why the men are collared and cuffed, why they're the ones that are tied, why you've all been given the myth of patriarchy when it's the men that are collared and cuffed. And it's to do with the shape that you don't get taught. So the shape you don't get taught is the one that makes up things like triangles and squares. So we're taught they're basic shapes. That's not a basic shape. It's a secondary shape. It's made up of a primary shape, which is what? It's a straight line. Now, just very quickly, because I know we don't have time, I'm not going to get into the ins and outs of drawing the line and crossing the line, but drawing the line and crossing the line are the ways that we bring change. If you don't get taught about the line, then you won't know how to look after your state, because you can't draw a line around yourself, and you won't be able to bring change because you can't cross the line. You can't take the charge for it. But the key here is, it's about the belief in yourself that what you have to bring for change has value, and that is to do with the secrets of the real basic shapes, because the real basic shapes are fractals, and they can become anything. They can become a picture. They can become a number. They can become a letter. They can become anything. Squares can't become characters. They can't become numbers. You know, triangles don't either. They're just fixed. They're triangles. So if I say to you the line, what is it? If it's a character, what is it? No, if you draw a line, what character is it from there? It's an eye. Okay, it's an eye. You don't get taught about the character that is about the eye, which is about you. When we talk about it now, if I give it a number, what number is it?
One.
So people are understanding the feminine one, which is O-N-E. What's missing is the masculine one, which is the line. You know, and it's like, it is not O-N-E, it is a bunch of ones. We are a bunch of ones. We're a bunch of eyes. And it is the balance of the coming together as the collective one, which is the O-N-E, that's the love, the connection, all that, which we're much more familiar with. But the thing, the edge we've got to bring is how we draw the line, which is how, and this is what's been going on in everybody's lives for the last few years, is a great space initiation, which is, you know, we're all being left in our own spaces. And it is to find out whether we are capable of drawing the line or not, you know, to find out, do you know who you are? Well, you're not a you, that's a different character of the alphabet. Yeah. You're an I. And if you don't know the value of the I, then it means you'll always look to other people to find out what you're worth. You'll always be looking to other people for your value, and that's the problem.
That is exactly the problem. And I think just to cap that one off, to a geometer, a dot, a circle, and a line are the same thing. They're the three faces of unity.
Yeah, that's right.
I totally agree, because the other word for the dot is the point. And it is the first, that's the first basic shape. It's the point, it's the ultimate fractal. It's the point of this conversation, the point of the world, ultimate fractal. But so are the other basic shapes, drawing the line, drawing the circle, drawing the spiral. These are all powerful fractals to play with that will actually heal your mind. And it is actually a native tool of ours. And it's so interesting because it comes to, just to finish off, what is the tool that draws the line? What tool do you draw a line with? What's the best tool? What do you call it?
A pen.
And then what do you run the pen down to draw the best tool?
A ruler.
You know, and you don't get taught the shape that is about the ruler. And it's about you, the ruler is the one who is in charge of a state. And so because you don't get taught any of that stuff, people can't take charge of their state. They don't think there's any value in it. And that makes us vulnerable. It makes us prone to being vulnerable in these encounters. So to me, the sole mission is to master your conduct first, because otherwise you're a liability. Your liability, you're going out there, you're not giving yourself good, you're not giving good account of yourself, you're not even respecting the arena, you're not even respecting the enormity of the task ahead. You know, you're not even respecting the enormity of what you're going up against. It's just go in and start ranting and shouting like a petulant child. I've been there, I've done it, you know, so it's like, I know what that's like, and then I've realised the error of my ways. It's not a man's solution.
No, like you say, the thing is to embody it, not explain it. That's
yes,
it, fundamentally.
Not to demand it
either. You can only perform through your behaviour. And through your behaviour, you will be determining what it is that other people deem you to be. So that's really great. Thank you very much, Christopher stroke Darren. Thanks very much to Pippa King earlier on for coming in. And she's still over there. Hiya, Pippa. And thanks to Katie and to Alex from Mobius Loop. And, of course, to Adrian. Adrian and John for coming on. So we've had a fair few people in, being as there was a reference to a Jewish princess going from Egypt over to Ireland to marry or something. I'm going to play out with Pretty Little Jewish Princess by Frank Zappa, because I'm going to go out and party. So it's actually quite a tasteful song, isn't it, for Frank? I won't. Next Thursday I am once again going to be out treading the boards, doing the Winter's Tale, so it will have to be another pre-recorded show. I don't know what it's going to be, but there will be something next Thursday. I'll join you in the chat box before the end of the show. And here's Frank Zappa. Thanks to all of you for being there. I'll see you Thursday, when I should be back home again. Cheers, folks.